Welcome to Minnesota Jazz Legends 2026. I'm Patty Peterson. Our state is fortunate to be the home of many gifted jazz musicians, and they've performed and recorded for decades right here, enriching our cultural environment. Each year, Jazz 88 thanks and honors a new class of legends with a concert and this radio special. In the coming hour, we'll hear them in previously recorded interviews and at a live concert, which took place on April 12, 2026, at the Minnesota History Center's 3M Theater. The 2026 Minnesota Jazz Legends are award-winning vocalist and radio personality Arnie Fogel, bassist and educator Gary Rayner, jazz vocalist the late Shirley Witherspoon, and jazz drummer and innovator Gary Gauger. The honorees are backed by the house band, Phil Aaron on piano, Graydon Peterson on bass, and Jay Epstein on drums. This show is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and produced by Jazz 88 KBEM. We begin with 2026 Minnesota jazz legend Arnie Fogel. For more than 50 years, Arnie's been part of the Minnesota music world as a singer, broadcaster, and a record producer. He has loved singing songs from the Great American Songbook for his audiences, and he's done it for decades. He's also known for producing Bing Crosby radio programs and writing the liner notes for archival Crosby recordings. Arnie Fogel's lifelong dedication to the music he loves has been widely recognized and honored, and for that, he's been inducted into the Minnesota Music Hall of Fame. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Arnie Fogel.
Beautiful miracle, pardon my lyrical rhapsody, but can't you see, oh, you have captured me, being so glamorous, can't you be amorous just with me, make it soon, grab a look at that moon, love is just around the corner, any cozy little corner. Love is just around the corner when I'm around you. I'm a sentimental mourner, and I couldn't be forlorner when you keep me on the corner, just waiting for you. Venus de Milo was noted for her charms. Strictly between us, you're cuter than Venus. What's more, you've got arms. Let's go cuddle in a corner, any cozy little corner. Love is just around the corner when I'm around you, babe. When I'm around you, hon. When I'm around you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for asking me. I'm overwhelmed, and I'm not usually overwhelmed.
Take me back to when you fell in love with music.
Oh, I think, you know, when I was a child, I loved it, but I didn't know I loved it. I thought I was going to be a cartoonist. That was my goal in life when I was in the single digits. But my sister kept bringing home presents for my dad in the form of record albums. Louis Armstrong, Satch Plays, Fats, Frank Sinatra, Come Dance With Me. And the Five Pennies, Louis Armstrong and Danny Kaye. And I learned all those songs, all of them, before I knew what I was doing.
How old were you?
I don't know, 9, 10
wow.
or something. But I didn't know that I loved them, except I kind of liked them. Certainly never thought of myself rejecting the cartoonist life, but I got lazy and I decided I don't like doing this anymore. I like that. I discovered that I could carry a tune and took it from there.
Was jazz the first music that you sang out in public? Because I also know you've dabbled in more top 40 stuff.
The very first time I sang in public was more stage-oriented things, which tended to be more pop-oriented things. You know, I joined a band and when I was a junior in high school, because that was the only kind of singing you could do then. The older singers hadn't discovered the young songwriters quite yet. Jazz kind of went by the wayside.
But people started to hear about you. How come you were doing a session at 19? What was that?
Because of some wonderful people that I tear up a little bit when I think about them now, because I love them so much, and I love that part of my life. This was Gary Pollock and Barry Thomas Goldberg, who were the lead songwriters in a group which eventually was called The Batch.
Steve Longman and I came looking for a recording studio and a recording deal. Pretty soon, as time evolved, I hooked up with these other guys, and Dale Menton was kind enough to give me an opportunity to sing in studio. And that opened a wide door for me, because Herb Pilhofer, who owned the studio, said, "Hey, who's that kid?" And pretty soon I was had a regular job singing on commercials.
Talk to me about how you got into the radio industry, because I know as an artist, you've been given some awards. You're in the Minnesota Music Hall of Fame and the Midwest Music Hall of Fame. But when you got into radio, you really decided that you were going to embrace it, and you have kept in the genre of staying in jazz, including being one of the key people in Bing Crosby's family's life.
I did know them, and I did have the opportunity to experience some things with them. But in general, the radio business, just when that band that I just talked about so lovingly eventually broke up, I was looking for something to do. The general manager of this one small station, KUXL in Golden Valley, his name was John Akuli, and he said on the air one day, "If anybody's got something interesting to say on the air, let us know." And I went, "Okay." And I let them know, and he tossed a book at me, How to Get a License. And he said, "Get your third-class ticket," third-class license he meant, "and I'll give you a job." So I did that.
And what age?
I was already about 25, something like that. Before I knew it, I was working on the radio, and I haven't been off the radio, you know, an actual show hosted by me, for 50 years.
Wow. Arnie Vogel, the Bing Shift.
Thanks.
It's a calling, and you do it so well, both singing and radio.
I'm Arnie Fogel. This is The Bing Shift.
Once I met a happy little bluebird. I was just as blue as I could be. In a little while, I began to smile when he sang this merry song to me.
When did you get into the Bing Crosby Show? What was the official name of that?
It was called Bing's Basement. There's so many great people impacted whatever it is I did. This was a guy named Robert S. Bader, and he ended up as the CEO of Bing Crosby Productions. Robert is also a writer and wanted to co-produce this series with me. And with Crosby's ownership of a number of the materials that we used, we developed, you know, the items that were in Bing's basement. I got to be in Bing's basement and look at all the old films and records and things that weren't released and were to be released. And he devised this format where we would play these rarities, the things that were found in Bing's basement. And I co-wrote with him and narrated the complete series. We were able to do that for a year and a half.
And then you brought it to the Twin Cities, and you're here at Jazz 88 bringing it every single Sunday night. The Bing Shift,
yeah,
right? Something similar.
Can't believe we're in our third decade now, and I love doing it, and long may it continue.
Be your big umbrella on a rainy, rainy day.
Let me get back to singing now, because you have a new album that has come out. It's been quite a process for you as well, right?
It's been a long time a-brewing, and it's called Arnthology. Music from a variety of sources in a variety of years. It goes back to 1971 and up to the present day. And this album has just a little compendium of things I've done. The whole album is kind of anchored by a group of sessions I did with Rick Carlson in 2006, and it was about the best singing I've ever done, and I said, I gotta release that, and I finally did.
All by myself, every morning, I'm all by myself, every night, and I sit alone
with a table and a chair. So unhappy there, just playing solitaire. I'm all by myself. I get so lonely just watching the clock on the shelf. Don't you know I'd love to rest my weary head on somebody's shoulder? I don't wanna grow older all by myself.
Talk about some of the people you have warmed up for, that you've sung with. I know Rosemary Clooney's on your bio and people like that.
See, I opened for Rosemary. I got to know Catherine Crosby and Peggy Lee. I interviewed Peggy Lee. She's a warm, wonderful person. And I asked her some question about something or other. She said, "You couldn't have said anything that would have pleased me more." And I thought, oh, yeah.
Do you have a high point?
Professionally? Probably is the day I accidentally, I traveled to see him put on a show in San Francisco, but the fact that I ran into him and talked to him and got an autograph and shook his hand was unexpected, and that was Bing Crosby. About a year before he passed away, he was quite active, singing and making albums again and doing personal appearances for the first time since the 1930s. And it was early morning, got off the plane. I was about a half block away, walking towards the venue, San Francisco Auditorium, because I just wanted to check it out. And about a block away, I started to make out a figure in the distance. And as I got closer, I realized, that's Bing Crosby. And I made a beeline to where he was, and I said, "Excuse me, sir, I've traveled all the way from Minnesota to see your show. Got to get your autograph. I've got my flight plan here on a piece of paper. Could you please sign it? I've got 1,600 of your records." And he said, "Boy, you must have them all." And I said, "Almost."
"'Cause I never take her where the gang goes when I take my sugar to tea."
When they say your name in years to come, what do you hope they're going to say about Arnie Fogel?
That they like what I projected, that it takes them a little while to find somebody else who can project the same thing. That's what I aim to do, is to let people know, to tell people what I'm enthusiastic about and hope that they may like it too.
Oh, that's a great way to put it. Want to do another song?
Sure, let's do this particular song, which is my favorite song by Rodgers and Hart. Lawrence Hart's words are kind of silly, but they're very profound and very deep and very personal. And that's kind of why I like it, because it's both silly and personal.
One, two, three, four. I'm a sentimental sap, that's all. What's the use of trying not to fall? I have no will. You made your kill. You took advantage of me. I'm just like an apple on a bough, and you're gonna shake me down somehow. What's the use? You cooked my goose. You took advantage of me. I'm so hot and bothered that I don't know my elbow from my ear. Suffer something awful each time you go, but much worse when you're near. Here I am with all my bridges burnt, just a babe in arms where you're concerned. So lock the doors, call me yours. You took advantage of me.
Is there any words of advice, encouragement?
Practice every day. I didn't have any teachers, but yes, I did. Their names were Crosby, their names were Sinatra, their names were Armstrong, their names were Dean Martin. My advice would be good and get better.
Now I'm so hot and bothered that I don't know my elbow from my ear. Suffer something awful each time you go, much worse when you're near. Here I am with all my bridges burned, just a babe in arms where you're concerned. So lock the doors and call me yours. You took advantage of me. Yeah, you took advantage of me. You took advantage of me.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Arnie Fogel. You're listening to Minnesota Jazz Legends 2026. I'm Patti Peterson. The next in our Forum member class of 2026 is one of Minnesota's most respected and versatile bassists, Gary Rayner. His musical journey began out east, where he earned a master's in orchestral music. But when Gary made his way to Minnesota, he quickly became a first-call pop and jazz bassist, playing for shows at nightclubs and in theater productions. While playing a show at the Carlton Celebrity Room in Bloomington, Gary Rayner got an offer he couldn't refuse, a national tour with one of the members of the Rat Pack. Please help me welcome to the stage Gary Rayner. From New York. What in the world brought you to Minneapolis and St. Paul?
Well, I'm originally like a Long Island suburban kid, but most of my aunts and uncles and cousins all lived in the boroughs of New York. I was finishing up actually a master's in music and really wanted to move into New York and see what would happen. But I also happen to have been on one of the very worst lounge bands in the world when I kind of came through here in 72.
Worst lounge bands?
Yeah, and I met the person who would become my wife because she was a waitress at, it was called Farrell's Ice Cream Parlor, and she was a pretty blonde, so I left her kind of like a $5 tip. She said the only person who ever left a tip that big was H.R. Haldeman. So we kept in touch, and she came out east to do an internship there and stayed with my family, and she was going to go home, and I figured that if she went home, I probably wasn't going to see her again, so I had to make some quick decisions, and I did. So we got married. She kind of hated it out there. She came from a small town, and she really wanted to go home to Minnesota. And she said, you know, we can annul this, but I'm going home. And I just figured, well, I did get married, so I supposed I should go along. And my bass teacher at that time said, don't go to Minneapolis, whatever. He wanted me to stay in New York. But
he wanted to keep you for himself, I think.
Well, I wasn't that big a prize. I did come out here, yeah. We came in with my wife, Cindy, and my big German Shepherd in an old Ford Econoline van. And we stopped at the Roseville Holiday Inn, and the next morning when I got out, it was like 44 degrees below zero. And I thought, what in God's name am I doing here? But I'm still here, so I guess.
While you stayed here, you continue to play your music. You've done so many things. You've worked at the Carlton Celebrity Room, Chan Hessen Dinner Theater, the Guthrie. You've done recording sessions. You've played jazz. You've played pop. You were given a lot of great opportunities. The expression you used when you were saying, I have been able to meet and play with some of my musical heroes. But yeah. Let's go back to the Carlton Celebrity Room for just a minute.
Well, Sammy Davis Jr. had just come in for a 2-week run in January. And the first thing he said was, what the hell am I doing here? It's so, you know, because that's a guy who likes warm. It was great. He liked to do things that had not been rehearsed, where he could just start singing a song and his rhythm section would pick it up. And since I grew up on standards, I knew all the songs. So he introduced me on the last night. He introduced his band, and then he introduced me as, this is one of your guys. And he looked up at me, he said, tell me, what's your ethnic background? And I said, the same as yours, because he was Jewish. he liked it. Because it was a bit, you know, it got a laugh. And then I just stayed in touch with them saying, I want to be in this band, I'm still here. And they asked me to come down during Mardi Gras in New Orleans, and I tried out with them, and then I stayed.
So how long did you tour Sammy Davis Jr.?
About 3 years. I mean, it wasn't all that much, but it's like I already had like a two-year-old son, and that was really hard on Cindy and Josh. As much as I could have stayed and would like to have stayed, I might not have had a marriage. And there are a lot of people who give up the marriage just to stay on the road, and I didn't want to be that dumb.
And I am telling you, I'm not going. You're the best thing I'll ever know. There's just no way I ever can go. I'm not living without you. I don't want to be free. I'm staying in Dick. You're gonna love me.
I loved playing with Sammy, and I thought, man, I have found the job for me. I mean, I knew all the tunes, and you'd have to know what it was and jump in, and, you know, I could do that pretty well. When I came home in 1983, so I was there from like 81 to 82 and 83, I really had, it was like depression. I mean, I missed the thrill of playing behind one of the greatest entertainers anybody is ever going to see. Well, I got here. I picked up some jazz jobs, some accompanying some singers. Mostly I played with Bob Gilbertson and his Riverboat Ramblers up until the midsummer. And then Dick Whitbeck asked me if I'd like to be in this new concept band called Rupert's. It was the Rupert's Band. It was R&B and pop, with three violins and tuxedos, you know. And I eventually got tendonitis in both arms and I had to stop. I couldn't really play much of anything for about a year and a half. But then when I started coming back, I came back with Debbie Duncan. I introduced her to Lowell Pickett. We worked a lot at the old Dakota. Sometimes we worked at the Artist Quarter. We did this for quite a while. I mean, from about 88 through the early 90s. Probably arranged most of her first album that was live from the Dakota. But then I started getting traveling Broadway shows, like at the Orpheum or the State in Minneapolis and the Ordway in St. Paul. And those grew to be, for most of the 90s, sometimes they were just back to back.
Gary, how did you come to work with Adi Yeshaya?
He's a writer and arranger, and he wanted to put together a band. And I can't remember exactly when it was or how it was that I brought Debbie over to meet Audie, but after he heard her, he just thought, okay, I'm going to put together this big band and she's going to be the singer.
Talk to me about some of the musical heroes you've played with as a result of being on Prairie Home Companion.
Yeah, on Prairie Home Companion. Prairie Home Companion was just an amazing job because we had a great band. So I got a chance to play with James Taylor, with Carole King. I got a chance a number of times to play with Wynton Marsalis. Yo-Yo Ma has always been like a real hero of mine. And I played a couple of duets with Edgar Meyer. And I got a chance to play with Aaron Neville and Dr. John and Renee Fleming, who I'm playing opera. And the great thing was that our band wasn't just one band. I mean, he might have three different acts in a show that we accompanied. We could do a country thing, and then we had to be a country band. Then Wynton Marsalis would come out. Then we'd have to be Wynton's band. And it was an amazing learning experience of how to understand styles quickly.
This is why Gary Rayner, initially from New York, is a Minnesota jazz legend in this. That's why. Do another song, would you? Gary Rayner, everyone.
If you wanted to be the star, you should have been a singer, a guitarist, a horn player. There's a wonderful feeling about being a bass player. When you're playing and everyone else is having a great night, a lot of it's because of you. You just play solidly and they have a great night. It's because you gave it to them. I mean, there are high points in music. There are certainly really some great things that I was happy to be there. But to find that I might have the respect of the people that I really respect in this business or just in this life is a great feeling.
You are listening to Minnesota Jazz Legends 2026. So far, we've celebrated honorees Arnie Fogel and Gary Rayner. Still to come, a celebration of the late vocalist Shirley Witherspoon and powerhouse drummer and innovator Gary Gauger. Our next Minnesota Jazz Legend is the late Shirley Witherspoon. Born and raised in Minneapolis, Shirley's remarkable talent led her to perform with Duke Ellington's orchestra. She returned home to become one of Minnesota's most beloved jazz vocalists, opening rooms and performing in concerts and on television. Her impact to Minnesota's music community was so significant that the state of Minnesota proclaimed a day in her honor. Today, we still celebrate the life and the legacy of Shirley Witherspoon.
Do nothing till you hear from me. Ain't no attention to what's said. Why people tell the seam of anyone's dream is over my head. True, I've been seen with someone new, but does that mean that I'm untrue? When we're apart, the words in my heart reveal how I feel about you. Some kisses haunting my memories, and although arms may hold a thrill, my pleas are nothing till you hear it from me.
Shirley's sister Nell reflects on growing up in the Witherspoon family.
Wherever we lived, we always had a piano. It just trickled down, I guess, through generations. You know, we were just gifted with musical ability and we liked to sing. We wouldn't take lessons or anything like that. It was just something that was just became natural. We didn't have a real prosperous type of life, but we had one another. And I think music was a part of that, getting over a lot of things that we didn't realize that we didn't have, you know, because we just did what we had to do. And this is how we made it through good times, hard times, full of love and serving the Lord with gladness of heart.
Some kisses haunt my memory.
Now, in Shirley's own words, let's hear how she started out in the business.
Well, I started out when I was 16, sneaking in the clubs, putting on gobs of makeup and padding, which I wish I could say I needed today. So I would put on my sister's dress and make up all kind of stuff and go to the Cassius Bar, this time, 3rd Avenue, 4th Street, across the street from the police station. And they had a back room where they had music. I wanted to sing so bad. I knew a lot of the songs that the cats were playing those days. So I would go in and I would hand them my phony ID. I'd say, hi, trying to be grown up, you know? He'd look at the ID, he'd go, okay, all right. I know you're a Witherspoon. Which one are you? I know you don't belong in here, little Witherspoon. You got to go. I said, please, please let me sing. Just let me sing some music. And I promise I'll go after that. They said, okay, 2 songs and you're out. So I'd sing 2 songs and they'd kick me out. I hung around with a lot of musicians. We didn't have a garage, but if we did, we'd be a garage band. You know, everybody would go over to Morris Wilson's house and jam, or we'd all get together in the park and jam, and it just came easy for me. I don't know how to explain it.
I sell them 3 times 7. And that makes almost 22.
Reverend Witherspoon, you want to come up and say a word about your sister?
Shirley, I remember sitting at my mother's house. It was on a Christmas Eve, and we got a phone call from Duke Ellington. Shirley said, yeah, right. And a week later, there were tickets in the mail for her to fly out to New York to start rehearsing with Duke Ellington. And that was the beginning of the launch of Shirley Witherspoon nationally and otherwise. One of the things that amazes me is Shirley could scat.
Yes.
And anybody that knows anything about jazz, scatting was not something every jazz singer could do. But surely it was an art for her. It was very easy for her.
Well, cigarette holders, I better wake me over his shoulder. I know he digs me out, cat. That's and all. Shadoo, you do, never do, you know. Skill, you do, baby.
long time. She didn't look until you do your didn't give away. Shy, 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 do battle, do battle, pain. Skinny, dear, photo, she bomb, but a little don't kick it down, bomb, but a little read on tea, you know, never to pay up. Shall a little day, but a day, but a ring, that away.
Oh, I met the Duke in 68 up in Wisconsin. Tony Wise's place, Hayward, Wisconsin. And Duke was under the big top, and I was across the way upstairs. That's how I met him. Tony got us together and said, come on, I want you to hear my singer. And so I went and sang a couple of tunes for him. I did Satin Doll and Stormy Monday Blues, which was the only blues that I knew at the time. I just did those for him, and that's it. That's how I met him.
Shirley was asked to join the Ellington Band, and her first gig was an extremely momentous occasion.
The 21st, 1969, January. And it was for the occasion of President Richard M. Nixon's inaugural ball. I was just in total awe. I learned professionalism from being with the Duke Ellington Orchestra. Before that, I was just a singer. But when I came back from the Ellington Band, I was a vocalist. And there's a difference.
Cigarette, how does that leave me? Over his shoulder, he digs me. I can't, that's sudden down. Well, and that's sudden down. Thank you very kindly. Thank you.
After her years with Duke Ellington's orchestra, where Mood Indigo was among her favorite songs to perform, Shirley returned to Minneapolis and spent many years appearing in concerts and on television with the Americana Classic Jazz Orchestra, also known as the Wolverines Orchestra.
Cause there ain't nobody cares about me. I'm just as blue as can be. When I get that blue and echo, I could lay me down and die.
Shirley Witherspoon also performed at jazz groups in clubs and concert settings and recorded with a variety of jazz musicians as well. Bassist Jay Young reflects on the charisma and stage presence Shirley had that made her such a compelling performer.
It ended up being hysteria. People were just fanatical about her. When I met her at a place called Night Train, which was two railroad cars together, we had a Friday, Saturday. We filled the place up. People came. She entertained. That's why they couldn't deny her of her presence.
I may be in a crowd, but for crying out loud, darling, please save your love for me.
Shirley's career expanded into theatrical productions in the Twin Cities. Dan Chouinard was the pianist that played with her on several occasions.
The first project I did with her was a show called Lady Day, and that was at the Cricket Theater in the early 90s. We toured that show a little bit. That was a lot of Billie Holiday music and Billie Holiday's story.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar tree.
But in 2001, we did a collaboration with Theatre Latida called The Death of Bessie Smith. It was a short play by Edward Albee. supplementing that with music by Bessie Smith as interpreted by Shirley Witherspoon. But it ran for a month and it sold out, as you might imagine, and think it might have been a last opportunity to see Shirley, because her health got more complicated in the 2 or 3 years after.
Here is a strange and bitter
Steve Heckler, founder of the Twin Cities Jazz Festival and Hot Springs record label, was also drawn to Shirley's talent.
My first time I met her actually was at the Artist Quarter in downtown St. Paul. And I had walked in to see Bobby Peterson, I believe, and he had called up onto the stage a singer I had not seen before, Shirley Witherspoon. And watching her voice and just how she approaches jazz, I said, who is this? Later, I did a little research, her touring with Duke and how she got involved in that. And I was just fascinated that here she is in Minneapolis, and I just wanted to know more. And then I approached her. At the time, I had a small label. I was just trying to promote some jazz artists I thought needed some recognition, and I thought that she should be recorded. I felt Shirley deserved some top musicians to play with her, and I knew Kenny Warner from New York happened to be in town. So he was at the Dakota, along with Toots Thielman. What was great, Shirley picked and arranged all the songs. We just worked behind the scenes of making that happen. It came out fantastic.
The resulting 2001 recording entitled Magic and Love was Shirley's last release. Shirley Witherspoon passed away in June of 2003. From her work with Duke Ellington to her unforgettable performances in jazz and theater, Minnesota was fortunate to call her one of our own and a true jazz legend. You're listening to Minnesota Jazz Legends 2026. I'm Patti Peterson. The fourth of our 2026 Minnesota Jazz Legends is drummer and innovator Gary Gauger. Introduced to jazz as a young teen in Philadelphia, Gary grew up listening to the great big bands of Count Basie, Jimmy Dorsey, and Stan Kenton. When it came time to enlist in the military, Stan Kenton wrote a letter of recommendation that helped Gary join another renowned big band, the Airmen of Notes. After moving to Minnesota, he became a first call drummer for studio sessions, but one of Gary's proudest achievements came later. The creation of his own line of percussion instruments. Help me welcome to the stage drummer Gary Gauger.
Thank you. This is Gary Gauger, everybody. You're not originally from here, correct?
Nope. I'm from a little town called Pottstown, Pennsylvania, which is about 25, 30 miles west of Philadelphia. But most of the work I did was in Philadelphia. Went to a school called Westchester State College in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Went to Berklee School of Music for a semester and studied with with Alan Dawson, who was a great teacher, Tony Williams teacher.
Oh, wow.
And I was in the Airmen of Note for 4 years and then...
Yeah, don't skate over that.
Oh, don't want to get ahead of that. Yeah, okay.
He was in the Airmen of Note for 4 years. Do you know that big band? All right, play drums. Can we stay there for a minute?
Yeah.
Well, you got in the Airmen of Note, and that was really a key thing for you. You ended up and recording with a bunch of people.
The stage band we had over at Westchester was really good. There were some really great players in there. And one of the things, I had a chance to rehearse with the Stan Kenton band. And then a few months later, he asked me if I wanted to join the band. And I said, you know, the Vietnam War was in full swing at that time. And I said, you know, I've taken a teaching job in Valley Forge area schools. If I don't, I'll be drafted. And I said, do you know of any bands that I could get into? He said, remind me of this and I will send you an introductory letter. About a week later, he sent me this really nice letter, and an opening came up in the Airmen of Note, and I got a call and it said, if you want to come in, you have to decide within the next 3 weeks because we're doing a tour to California. We're working with Nancy Wilson. We're working with Shelley Mann and Joe Williams. And I put my notice in and went into basic training. 2-3 months later, I'm in a session with Nancy Wilson. I'm thinking, this is weird, because just 3 months ago, I'm teaching elementary band. And I thought, this is a little strange.
It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Shabba-dooby-dooby-doo-ya-doo-ba-da-doo-ee-doo-dee-ah. It don't mean a thing, all you got to do is sing.
What was your favorite thing about Joe Williams?
Saw him at Sunnybrook Ballroom. With the Basie band. And I remember I mentioned that to him when we would be listening to a playback. I wouldn't record. I says, Joe, I said, I remember seeing you at Sunnybrook. Oh, yeah. He says, "We that was a great club. We played there a couple of times." I said, yeah, I saw you when I was in high school. But he was just the nicest person to work with. And a couple times he'd just come back and the band would be on leave and we just put the rhythm section together and go over and record with him for about 3 or 4 hours because he was just such a joy. I was in at a time when so many great players, and there was a drummer that I used to share a gig with who was in the Army band. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. His name was Steve Gadd. Yeah, yeah. And the funny thing was, when I got out, I thought, I don't know if I can make a living at this or not, but I was doing some recording and working with a great group called the Free Design. It was only out for 2 weeks, and I got a call to do a show called Hair. With Meatloaf and Ted Lang were in it, who were nobody then. And I thought, this is wild. So I took the show, and the guy said, it pays $600 a week. I was making $125 as a tech sergeant in the Air Force. But he said, is that enough? I said, I think that's okay. Yeah. For 8 shows a week, and it ran for about 6 months, so it was quite an adventure.
Give me a head with hair, long, beautiful hair. Give me down the fair hair, shoulder length for longer.
You were doing that, and you were working with Free Design, doing incredible arrangements and original material. So you were in Canada for a minute, right?
Yeah, they had about 4 or 5 albums out already, and then I moved up. Chris Dedrick was the person who led the group, and he did a lot of production up there. So I sort of moved up there, and then I did an album with Michael Johnson. who Chris produced, and Phil Ramone. Phil Ramone was a producer for Paul Simon,
yeah.
And he was the session engineer on all this stuff, so it was really a treat.
If you play the fiddle and I'll beat the drum, we'll dance a crooked path for those who want to come.
How is it that you got to the Twin Cities then?
Steve Wright. You know, Steve Wright had a big band, and Steve was a trumpet player in the Airmen of Note. And he called me, said, can you come down and do an album I'm doing? And he said, I'd like you to play on it. So I came down. It was over at Sound 80 and state-of-the-art studio. And I did the session, and the fellow that owned it came in and said, say, could you stay tomorrow and do a session? So I stayed and did that, and he called me a couple of days later, can you come down next week and do another two sessions? So I did that. Finally, he just said, why don't you move down here?
I want to segue over into you and your decision to start inventing drums with different rims, which is now a trademark.
Resonance Isolation Mounting System.
Okay, but why would you do such a thing?
When I first got in the Airmen of Note, we went out to L.A. and we did these concerts with Shelly Manne. And he was probably one of the most recorded drummers. He was on jazz things. He was doing everything at Henry Mancini. He was doing several television shows. And when we did these shows with him, I got talking to him. And he had calfskin heads on his drums, and he had these beautiful sounding leady drums. And I said, Shelly, do you use those in the studio? Oh, he says, I only use wooden drums. And he said, I don't use any covering on them. You wouldn't put covering on a violin, he said. And I probably talked to him for about 3 hours, and he said, you know, I'm trying to get these companies to listen to me and get this hardware off the shelves. He says, drums are beautiful, but he said they attach all this metal hardware to the shells. And I thought, that's strange. So when I went back home, I started working on some things, because when you hold the drum up and hit it, it sounds totally different than when you put it back on the stand. And when I finally came up with this thing, I showed it to a number of the companies. They didn't know what it was, but then I started to find out that the companies, none of these people are drummers that run these drum companies. They're accountants, and I went to Slingerland, and I said to him, don't you notice a difference in your drums when you... He said, I got to stop you right there. He says, I'm a clarinet player. And I looked at his desk, and it said, President, Slingerland Drum Company. And I thought, nobody there played drums. It's Slingerland Drum Company. And it just amazed me. So after I went to about three or four companies, they didn't know what I had, and they said, no, we don't want to add $25, $30 to a drum kit. They're too expensive now. And a drummer was in town by the name of Bill Goodwin, who was in town with Phil Woods. And he came out to the house. He said, what are you going to do with this? And I said, I don't know. No company wants it. I said, I got a patent on it. I don't know. I can't give it away. He said, call Russ Kunkel. Well, Russ Kunkel was one of the most recorded drummers. He's on all the Carole King stuff, all the James Taylor, Linda Ronstadt, Jackson Brown. I called him, and I tried to explain it to him. He says, you know what, can you send me a picture? I sent him a picture, called me about 3 days later at 8:30 in the morning, and he says, Gary, this is one of the best things I've ever seen. How soon can you make these for my drum set? And I made them for one of his sets, and then he did a series of concerts in New York called Muse Concert. Did you remember that? Musicians United for Safe Energy, Madison Square Garden. And he called me, he said, listen, I put these on my drums. They used my drums for the whole show. You're gonna get a call from Keltner, you're gonna get a call from the Doobie Brothers, you're gonna get a call from the Grateful Dead. These guys are calling me. And for the first 3 years, everything I was making was going out to LA, to the studio musicians. So they were the ones that really cared about the sound. So one of the things I learned really fast was, you've got to go to the people that really know, because he just looked at a picture of it and he knew exactly what it did, so.
Would you do another song for us? Okay, Gary Gauger, everybody.
Thank you.
Can you think of one high point in your life as a musician?
I think the things that we did in the Airman Oak, because of all the different people that we worked with. Probably one of the most creative things I did was the thing we did with Michael Johnson. I remember I got to the session, Michael said, there's a guitarist coming up, he's gonna play on this, he should be here within the hour, he just got to the airport. And we started in on this one tune and I thought, wow, who is this guy? It was Leo Kottke, and I just found out he was one of the most amazing guitarists in the world.
Do you have a tip or a piece of advice for the up-and-coming jazz musicians?
Listen to all different kinds of music. Like I said, you know, one week I'd be playing the jazz club, next week I'm working with the symphony. Being able to play anything and listening to all kinds of music, I think, is important. Anytime I was playing, it was fun. They're gonna pay me to do this?
You've been listening to Minnesota Jazz Legends 2026 with honorees Arnie Fogel, Gary Rayner, Shirley Witherspoon, and Gary Gauger. Executive producer and host is Patty Peterson. Our honorees are backed by pianist Phil Aaron, bassist Graydon Peterson, and drummer Jay Epstein. Excerpts of Shirley Witherspoon's segment were provided by the Leigh Hammond Legacy Project and Dan Chouinard's Singer's Voice. Production engineers are Steve Weiss and Scott Melchow from Creation Audio and Plus Six Productions. Special thanks to Minnesota History Center's 3M Theater for the use of their stage for the live concert portion. This show has been brought to you by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and produced by Jazz 88 KBEM.